Prologue. He stops only twice, once to drink from a stream halfway up Elkhorn Ridge, and again a mile or two later for a handful of home-batch gorp. Otherwise, for two long, sweaty hours, he trudges up the switchback trail, taking care not to jostle the dangerous cargo in his pack. The ridgeline rises 2,000 feet from the valley floor of the narrow box canyon formed by the west fork of the Franklin River. To the east, past the canyon's mouth, he can just make out the northernmost tip of the county airfield and a short stretch of Highway 22 snaking through the Franklin Valley. Across the canyon lies the steep, forested hillside where the new ski resort is supposed to go in. If the Franklin Skiing Company gets its way, the entire south slope of Elkhorn Canyon, nearly 2,500 acres of old-growth blue spruce and bristlecone pine, will be clear-cut to make way for 26 freshly carved ski runs serviced by 6 high-speed lifts, transforming this pristine valley populated by elk and beaver and wildcats into a small, teeming American city of hotels and restaurants and parking lots. He set out hours ago, just a guy with a backpack and a rebuilt Schwinn racer cruising the old rail bed along the Franklin River. A couple of miles out of town, he scaled a low wooden fence and followed a rarely used Forest Service road along the backside of Elkhorn Ridge. When the gravel gave way to dirt, he ditched his bike in a stand of chokecherry bushes and set off on the 3-mile hike up the ridge. There are plenty of more direct routes to the West Fork Power Substation in the heart of Elkhorn Canyon. But at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, those trails will be populated by tourists and locals out for a weekend hike, and he very much does not want to be seen. In any case, he's in no hurry. "The straightest line between two points is no fun," he says out loud, repeating Jack Frost's famous line from A Screwdriver in the Gears. He has been hiking these remote woods for decades, first with his father hunting small game, and later with Bill Blanning, the man he has always considered his real father. It was Blanning who gave him the gift of patience, taught him to stand for hours at the edge of a meadow as the beavers built their dams and black bears foraged for roots and berries along the valley floor. Once, many years ago, they even spotted a lynx. These densely furred wildcats once ranged as far south as New Mexico, but they were nearly trapped out of existence below the Canadian border, and Elkhorn Canyon is one of their last remaining habitats in the United States. He's convinced that several breeding pairs are still out here, but if the three brothers who own the ski company get their way, the lynx will disappear from Elkhorn Canyon, and quite possibly the entire country. Dusk has fallen by the time he reaches the West Fork substation, but he hangs back in a patch of low-lying scrub oak, watching for any human presence. For weeks now, he and the other members of the collective have been doing recon, taking up posts here or in a stand of willows along the creek using Zeiss binoculars. A few times, always on Wednesdays and Friday mornings, trucks from the Mountain Power Company have pulled up at the service building and disgorged workers to recalibrate the sensors on the gauges and clear forest debris within a 50-yard radius of the perimeter fence. These visits never last longer than a couple of hours, and the inspection crews are always gone by noon, usually much earlier. Still, he waits for full dark before he snaps on a pair of surgical gloves, opens his pack, and begins assembling his materials. By the dim glow of his flashlight, he extracts the gauze-wrapped brick of industrial-grade TNT, formed into a disc small enough to fit under a transformer box. The blasting cap, a thin rod of mercury fulminate, is rigged into a Seiko digital wristwatch bought 2 weeks ago at a Fred Meyer department store in Roseburg, Oregon. When it's fitted into the explosive, it will be set to detonate at 5 p.m. the next day, Monday, October 11th, 1993. When he finishes assembling the bomb, he repacks the remaining materials in his backpack, peels off his shoes and socks, and walks barefoot along a narrow deer path to the substation. The complex is ringed on four sides by a chain-link fence, but it's only 8 feet high and unbarbed. He slides the bomb under the fence using a hole dug 2 days ago to look like the work of a small animal, tosses his pack over the fence, and begins climbing, his heavily calloused toes finding footholds in the diamonds of chain-linked metal. Dropping down inside the complex, he makes his way to the central transformer housing, careful to tread only on grass or cement. With a screwdriver, he removes a metal panel protecting the transformers and slots the slim disc of explosive on the concrete pad below a row of transformer boxes. If his calculations are correct, the explosion will blow the transformer apart, sending a fireball 30 feet into the air and setting off the circuit breakers. Since this is only one of two substations serving the Franklin Valley, power company engineers will be able to quickly redirect the power supply. Power will be out in Franklin for at most an hour or two, possibly less, if their sensors are better than he thinks they are, but it will go out. He engages the timing device and reaches into his pack for one final item, a small plastic box containing five bright flakes of blasted aluminum harvested from a Seiko watch identical to the one used in the timing device. Using tweezers, he sets the glittering shards of metal, each coated with a nearly invisible dusting of explosive powder, on the concrete pad below the transformer housing in a broad blast pattern. The last and largest aluminum flake, containing a nearly complete serial number, he inserts under a pillar as if it has lodged that way after the blast. He steps back to inspect his work, and when he's satisfied, he scans the site for any items. A glove, his sunglasses, a stray piece of clothing that he might have dropped. Seeing none, he screws the panel back into place, makes his way back to the fence line, and draws a 6x8 card from his pack. The hand-lettered note reads, "On behalf of the Lynx, we bring you an hour of darkness. Next time, we won't be so gentle. The Jack Frost Collective." He props the card against the base of the fence, well out of the blast radius. Then he slides his pack under the fence and clambers up and out of the substation compound. He has a long hike over the north rim of the canyon to the stand of chokecherry bushes where he ditched his bike. But at least now, at night, he can take main roads without being seen. He turns back for a final look at the darkened substation, flicks on his flashlight, and sets off along the service road.